Once upon a time, there were four little rabbits.
How old are you, Johnny? She asked.
16.
We few, we happy few, we band of brothers.
It was the best of times. It was the worst of times.
A wise old king once said, of the making of books, there is no end. How true today. Of the overabundance of writing published each year, what's worth reading? The answer is simple. Read only the best. Come join the discussion on Just the Best Literature.
Well, hello again, everyone. Thanks for listening in today. Well, with me in the studio, as always, is my producer, Mr. Dan Arnfeld. Good afternoon, Dan.
Hello.
Good to have you here with me. Now, today, basically, because I had caught the flu and was not able to tape a new program recently, the last couple of weeks, but I have fully recovered and it's back to business. So you can comment in the near future. So anyway, sorry about that, but those things happen when you're around a lot of college students and also high school students and grade school students. Someone gets sick, it's going to go everywhere somehow. So now on our last program, I continued discussing chapter 7, titled The Blackest of All Days, in part 2, Into Africa. And this is the chapter in Candace Millard's book, Hero of the Empire. Now, on that program, I did show you on page 81 that Winston believed he was not going anywhere quickly to the front of the war with the Boers because of Redvers Buller. He was the British commander-in-chief in South Africa. Now, this is one of the funniest things, I think, about Winston is there is a reason why Buller was not really impressed with Winston. And I'm going to talk to you just a little bit about that before we get into some other things today. So Buller definitely was not impressed with Winston. And here's what he had to say about Winston on page 84. And this is something that again, getting ready today, I thought this was not so much hilarious as it is probably true. And so this is page 84, and this is what is going on with Winston. Now, remember, everybody, that the whole basis behind this book is that Winston wanted to get back into a war situation where he could be a hero as a soldier. He was not taken as a soldier. He was there as a correspondent. And so in the back of his mind, he still wanted to be a warrior. And so this is what was going on. So at the third paragraph down on page 84, remember now, Churchill had been, he had gone to a military school. He really believed he understood, fighting and warring. And so here's what this third paragraph down. Now, he says, one night, soon after arriving in Cape Town, Churchill, on the strength of Joseph Chamberlain's letter of introduction, was invited to dine at a governor's house, the government house. Confidentially elbowing his way into a conversation between Milner and Buller, he criticized the government's colonial policy and then, turning his attention to the commander-in-chief, began to give him advice on how he should conduct his campaign. All right, so here's this young writer who's trying to be a hero telling the boss how to run the campaign. And then Buller, characteristically blunt, told Churchill not to be a young ass. And so you can see why he's not going anywhere. When you get invited to this big house with all these really high level guys, and you're a young person and you're a writer and you're telling them what they need to do to win the war. So anyway, Buller was not impressed with Winston, and now I'm going to continue on to page 85. Says from the bottom of page 84, it says, although he was urgently needed in Natal, Buller would have to wait until the ships that were now on the high seas carrying him additional men and supplies, caught up with him. Churchill, however, had no intention of cooling his heels in Cape Town. He had another plan. And if you remember from last time, for those of you that have been listening, is remember, I call it the dangerous plan. And so does Candace Miller, calls it the dangerous plan. It says, slipping into the city with Atkins, the correspondent for the Manchester Garden, he learned that there was a rail line to East London, a harbor town on the east coast of Cape Colony, from where he could take a British mail boat into Natal on the Indian Ocean coast. The journey by train alone would be 700 miles, all of it undefended, much of it bordering on Boer territory. Once in the besieged colony, it would be a breakneck race to make it to Ladysmith before the Boers had surrounded it completely. And just to add a little bit of understanding here, there was going to be a big battle at Ladysmith, and Winston wanted to make sure he got there because it would be one area that would give him the big push that he wanted. He could be famous if he could get into the battle at Ladysmith. And so, but what he wanted to do, it says, it goes on here, it says, once in the besieged colony, it would be a breakneck race to make it to Ladysmith before the Boers had surrounded it completely. That's what he wanted to do. He wanted to beat the Boers to Ladysmith. And at the end of this page, then, it says, when the other journalists learned of this desperate and dangerous plan, they were determined to find their own way out of the Cape. Churchill and Atkins' train, however, would be the last to get through. Churchill was determined to travel faster and further than any of them, and he would succeed. His carefully orchestrated life, however, was about to veer wildly off course. So his dangerous plan, and this is Candace is setting us up to show us that, you know, his carefully orchestrated life, however, was about to veer wildly off course. And so anyway, this is typical Winston Churchill, typical. And, you know, a lot of the times he came out okay. And so we'll see here what is going on. All right, so let's move into chapter 8 now. And again, this is page 86. And essentially what I'm going to do, I'll read some of page, some of chapter 80, chapter 8. And we'll read some of pages 86 to 92. But essentially what these pages are is a history of the African natives and a geography lesson of South African territory taken over by the Boers. And so you could really read these pages on your own. And it is interesting to understand about the geography of the this area of South Africa. Now, I'm thinking about, there are two students that I have in my English classes here that are actually from South Africa, and two young ladies, and I approached them, and I said, hey, would you consider coming onto the radio program just to talk about the geography of South Africa and what it was like growing up in South Africa? And one of them had said, oh, yeah, I'd really like to do that. So they even have this South African accent. So I thought that might be really cool for all of you out there listening to bring them on and let them talk about what they learned growing up about the Boer War with England. And so we'll see if that if we can do that. So anyway, but go ahead and like I said, I'm going to read to you part of chapter 8, and it's the one that deals with Winston Churchill. So what I'm going to do now is I'm going to go to page 92, and what I want to do is there was one really serious battle between the Boers and the natives of South Africa at that time, and there was the Zulu tribe. There were different tribes. And you have to remember that it's the Dutch moved in first, then the French came in, And then they were taking over the land. They were taking it away from the natives of there. So I'm going to go to page 92 now, and I want to basically discuss with you a battle. And it's at the bottom two paragraphs of page 92. And this is the history of the Battle of Blood River. So it's called the Battle of Blood River, and let me just read this to you. And the reason I'm bringing this out is it does take us right into where Churchill, got involved in this Boer War. It says the Boers. This is the third paragraph down. It says the Boers, however, although they had fewer than 500 men, were armed with rifles and cannon. By the end of the day, some 3,000 Zulu lay dead. In fact, so great was the slaughter that the river was said to have run red with their blood, and the Boers changed its name from the Nakom River to Blood River. So I'm just going to continue reading a little bit. After the Battle of Blood River, the Boers had claimed much of southern Natal, including Estecourt. Families such as Botha's quickly moved in and established farms that stretched over thousands of acres. Just 5 years later, the British swept in, annexing the Republic and forcing out most Boers who refused to live under British rule. And so part of this whole thing with this the Battle of Blood River is actually Winston Churchill left where he started and was going to come into that area of the Blood River. And so what do you think that the Boers wanted to do? They wanted to get back at the British at Blood River. And so it's really interesting. It says, as they had with the Zulu more than a half century before, the Boers had now returned to settle the score. This time, they had not hundreds of men in their ranks, but thousands. They were encamped near Estcourt and Ladysmith and were hiding in all the hills in between. They were heavily armed, flushed with recent victory, fueled with moral outrage and impatient for the next battle to begin. So here is where Winston wanted to be, and here's where he was going to be. So now at the top of page 23, listen to this. And it's typical also of, the Winston saga. So this is talking about Winston. He says, after a ship landed at the Indian Ocean port of Durban on the eastern coast of Natal, Churchill was torn from his daydreams about this golden land of opportunity and harshly reminded of the hideous fact that Natal is invaded and assailed by the Boers. And so they were already there. As he and Atkins waited impatiently for the sun to rise, Churchill wanted only one thing, news of the war. When morning finally came, however, what he learned was exactly what he had feared. Ladysmith, just 125 miles to the northwest, had been cut off by the advancing Boers, and no one could get out or in. He had crossed African southern extremity at an incredible clip, easily outpacing Buller, his men, and the other correspondents in the race to Natal, but he had not been fast enough. I was too late, he wrote dismally. The door was shut. And so here, this was going to be his big opportunity to become famous, become the famous soldier. Didn't happen. And this is Winston, and if Buller ever found out, I guess he'd probably be chuckling in the background. Candace keeps, she writes on, angry and exhausted, Churchill was nonetheless determined to keep going. Now remember about Winston Churchill, she doesn't bring it out here, but I'll bring it out just briefly. We have to remember now, Winston Churchill and his stomach couldn't take the ocean all the time. And so obviously He was angry and exhausted because he was on another ship that was just bouncing. It was just a little mail ship. It was bouncing all around the ocean, so he did not have a good night's sleep and probably couldn't keep anything down either. So that's why he's so angry and exhausted. And but nonetheless, I mean, one of the positive things about Winston Churchill, he was determined. He wasn't going to give up yet. Said, as far as you can quickly, he said, as far as you can, as quickly as you can, must be the motto of the war correspondent, he wrote. So this is what he wrote back to his, you know, his publishers. As far as you can quickly as you can must be the motto of the war correspondent, he wrote. Finding a place on the mail train that was headed inland, he made his way through the mountains once again, northwest this time, on a zigzagging railway that contorts itself into curves that would horrify the domestic engineer. So can you imagine? He's now in a mountainous area of South Africa. Finally, on November 6th, his train pulled into the railway station at Estcourt, the new front of the war. So finally, he did get to the front of the war. He says, most of the British troops in Estcourt knew little and likely cared less about the history of the blood-soaked land over which they had carelessly set up their tents and tossed their bags. They were very much aware, however, of the modern-day Boers watching them from the surrounding hills. Even the Boers themselves were stunned by the sheer number of burghers now scattered between Estcourt and Ladysmith. As I approached, I saw thousands of fires springing up on the hills. Denise Ritz, the young man who had left Pretoria with Botha, wrote after arriving in the region one night from Dundee, the commandos were strung out over several miles. So you can see that the Boers were ready. They were really ready for a fight. And in some ways, Winston was going to get exactly what he wanted to get. All right. Let me just keep reading here just a little bit. It says, in sharp contrast to the enemy, the British fort at Estcourt was so small it had a little hope of defending itself, much less charging into Ladysmith and freeing White and his men. And remember now, White is another British commander, and his White and his men are stuck in Ladysmith. Because Buller had yet to arrive, there were only two battalions. And so you can see here that Buller didn't like Winston, but Buller was stupid as well. He was supposed to, you know, get in there, and he just dilly-dallied, you know. Again, you could see where Winston Churchill was a little bit, maybe he was a little bit more knowledgeable, Buller, and how to handle the war. It says, It says the Royal Dublin Fusiliers, who had already fought one battle and had only just made it out of Ladysmith themselves, and a squadron of the Imperial Light Horse, a group of 300 volunteers from Natal, had also arrived, bringing with them 25 bicyclists and a battery of nine-pounder guns rolled on an enormous spoked wheels. Even with this welcome addition, there were still only about 2,300 men in Estcourt, fewer than 300 of whom were mounted. The enemy crouches at our door, Atkins wrote uneasily as he and Churchill took stock of their new home. This place is scarcely defensible. And so Winston wanted to get there, and it turns out it's a pretty dangerous place to be. It is really, really kind of interesting how he survived this, but the best still is yet to come of what we're going to read about Winston in South Africa. It says every British soldier and officer knew that the question was not whether the Boers would attack Estcourt, but when. What they couldn't understand was why the commandos hadn't already descended on their small force, which every day threatened to grow into a much larger one. It was a period of strained waiting, when everyone wondered whether a Boer commando or a British brigade would be the first arrival, one of the soldiers would later write, "Reliable news was scarce, though rumors of every kind were rife. It was not difficult to picture the Boers streaming down the hills or suddenly turning their massive guns from Ladysmith to escort. We live," Churchill wrote matter-of-factly, "in expectation of attack." And so he was there. That's where he wanted to be. And it's interesting. Now, what I'm going to do is I'm going to move on to chapter 9. And essentially, I was going to wait and begin this next time. But we still have a few minutes left. So I'm going to just begin to introduce chapter 9 now. Now, chapter 9 is called The Death Trap. And so, in some ways, my wife would really like this chapter because we've had a mouse in the house. And she's been trying to kill this mouse for a long time. And she finally got her way. We went to our favorite store, Lowe's, and we got the little mouse traps where you put peanut butter on one end, you open it up, and it looks like a pair of, like someone's teeth, and it snaps. When they go to get the peanut butter, snaps right on their head. And the other morning, before I got out of bed, she was really excited and smiling and happy, and I said, "What happened?" She says, "The mouse is dead." So now she has these little things everywhere because she thinks there's more than one mouse in the house. And then she's mad at the cat, too, by the way, because she feels that the cat isn't doing her business for getting the... I said, "Well, the dead ones, just give them to her. Maybe she just needs to be reminded that she could eat them, you know." And so anyway, I'm getting off the story here. We still have 5 minutes. All right. So the thing is... This is a death trap. So Churchill cursed his luck for missing the chance to enter Ladysmith, but it was not the first time in war that he had arrived too late. Less than a year earlier, after talking his way into a military assignment in the Sudan, he had raced to Africa, only to find that the position that had promised him had already been given to another man. Churchill was particularly furious about the missed opportunity because his squadron was to lead the attack on the dervishes. Now, he really grew a lot of fame from the Sudan, from fighting in the Sudan with the dervishes. The man who had taken his place, Second Lieutenant Robert Grenfell, on the other hand, was thrilled. "Fancy how lucky I am," he had written to his family after hearing the news. "Here I've got the troop that would have been Winston's, and we are to be the first to start." Not long after he had written the letter, Grenfell rode triumphantly into battle, only to be slaughtered along with many of the men in his regiment. "Chance is unceasingly at work in our lives," Churchill would write later, thinking back on Grenfell and the fate that might have been his, "but we cannot always see its working sharply and clearly defined." And that is something that Churchill... he did believe that God had protected him many times, and just as much as President-elect Trump realized that even in Pennsylvania, that bullet hit his ear, it did not hit his brain, and he believed God intervened for that. And so I think there's a lot of people in this world, the fact that he is now President-elect is also God's doing in all of that. Now, just continue, we're on page 97 right now. It says, Churchill, now still too young to see the workings of chance in his life, certainly cannot imagine that there might be any benefit or excitement to being trapped in escort, bitterly resigning himself to this tiny, tiny tin township. He looked in his new home with a weary eye. It was of mean and insignificant aspect, he wrote gloomily. There were a few shops, but they were housed in unpretentious shanties and nearly all abandoned since the outset of war. A scattering of low stone and corrugated iron houses lined Estcourt's only street, and Churchill could see a few more straggling away towards the country. Beyond that, toward the northwest and the Boer lines, there was nothing but the flat green veld and a few low hills. To the southwest, he could see the misty blue peaks of the Drakensberg Afrikaans for Dragon Mountains. Hauling his bag from the train, Churchill looked for a place to stay near the railroad station where most of the men had set up camp. He found an empty bell tent in the shunting triangle where train cars were coupled and uncoupled and decided to make it his home for the time being. Because there were more men than tents, he was obliged to share his, choosing for his roommates two other journalists, Atkins, who had accompanied him as he had raced across the Great Karoo, and a young London Times correspondent named Leo Amery. Although in theory Atkins was his competition, Churchill liked him. He admired his Cambridge education and the fact that, at just 28 years of age, he had already covered several wars, including the Spanish-American War and the Greco-Turkish War 2 years earlier. Atkins was, Churchill wrote to his mother, exceedingly clever and accomplished. Perhaps what he liked best about his new friend, however, was how interested Atkins seemed to be in him and how willingly he was to listen to him talk about himself. So doesn't that sound like Churchill? Hey, my best friends let me talk about myself all the time. And so anyway, that's pretty interesting. Now, for his part, Atkins found Churchill not just amusing, but fascinating. He had seen his like only once before in Cuba during the Spanish-American War, where Atkins had at lunch with Theodore Roosevelt. Now that's pretty interesting, you know, with Teddy Roosevelt and his team. So the young reporter had watched as the Rough Riders, the mostly crew of cowboys, college athletes, and law enforcement officials Roosevelt had brought together to fight the war, gathered eagerly around him, hanging on his every word. It was like conference, Atkins later wrote, with Roosevelt as both principal speaker and chairman. So anyway, before they parted ways, Roosevelt, who was just 3 years later would become the youngest president in U.S. history, pulled Atkins aside to tell him that, so far as he knew, he was the only officer who had performed the feat of shooting a Spaniard with his revolver in the charge up the slopes. So you can see Roosevelt, he liked his wars as well. So, well, that's all the time I have for today's program. Now, on our next program, we will continue into chapter letter 9, the death trap. So we'll continue on chapter 9, the death trap. And now remember, this book is a wonderful supplement to Winston Churchill's book, My Early Life, and continues the history of Winston's success in politics and the Boer War. Now you can buy a new or used copy of Candace Millard's book at Amazon.com. You may also be able to find a copy in your local bookstore. And of course, you can also check your local library. So please write me any comments you may have to jbl@pcog.org. You can follow JBL on Twitter at JBLiterature1. And you can also follow JBL on Facebook. Simply search for Just the Best Literature. So until next time, keep reading.
You've been listening to Just the Best Literature on Trumpet Radio, 101.3 KPCG, streaming online at kpcg.fm and thetrumpet.com.